நாராயணம் நமஸ்கிருத்யா நாரஞ்சைவ நரோத்தமம் தேவிம் சரஸ்வதிம் வியாசம் ததோ ஜாய முதீரயே நஷ்ட ப்ராயேஷு அபத்ரேஷு நித்யம் பாகவத சேவயா பகவதி உத்தம ஸ்லோகே பக்திர் பவதி நைஷ்டிகி. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 13, Text 35. Iti vyavastita vipras tasya gryagnya prajataye purodasham niravapan shipi vishtaya vishnave. Iti vyavastita vipras tasya rajnya prajataye purodasham niravapan shipi vishtaya vishnave. Iti vyavastita vipras tasya rajnya prajataye purodasham niravapan shipi vishtaya vishnave. Iti, thus, vyavastita, having decided, vipraha, the brahmanas, tasya, his, rajnya, of the king, prajataye, for the purpose of getting a son, purodasham, the paraphernalia of sacrifice, niravapan, offered shipi vishtaya to the Lord, who is situated in the sacrificial fire, vishnave to Lord Vishnu. Translation purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation: thus, for the sake of a son for King Anga, they decided to offer oblations to Lord Vishnu, who is situated in the hearts of all living entities. Purport: according to sacrificial rituals, animals are sometimes sacrificed in the yajna arena. Some such animals are sacrificed not to kill them, but to give them new life. Such action was an experiment to observe whether the Vedic mantras were being properly pronounced. Sometimes, small animals are killed in a medical laboratory to investigate therapeutic effects. In a medical clinic, the animals are not revived, but in the yajna arena, when animals were sacrificed, they were again given life by the potency of Vedic mantras. The word Shipi Vishtaya appears in this verse. Shipi means the flames of the sacrifice. In the sacrificial fire, if the oblations are offered into the flames, then Lord Vishnu is situated there in the form of the flames. Therefore, Lord Vishnu is known as Shipi Vishta. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Gnanjana Shilakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Swapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutapadakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitam Tamsajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitamscha Namam Vishnupadaya Krishna Preshtaya Bhutale Srimate Jayapataka Swamiti Namine Namocharya Padaya Nitai Kripa Pradayine Gauravata Damadaya Nagara Gramatharine Namam Vishnupadaya Krishna Preshtaya Bhutale Srimate Gopi Paranadana Dase Iti Namine Namam Vishnupadaya Krishna Preshtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamiti Namine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshtarine Manchakal Katarubhyascha Kukasandubhi Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Mukam Karoti Vachalam Pangum Langayate Giram Nitkripatamaham Bandeshi Gurundaran Nitkripatamunde Paramananda Madhyam Shri Chaitanyeshwaram Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Katanchana Smate Yasmin Dushkaram Sukaram Bhavet Vismrite Virpreetam Syat Sri Chaitanyam Namamitam. Translation. Thus, for the sake of a son, for King Anga, they decided to offer oblations to Lord Vishnu, who is situated in the hearts of all living entities. So here in this purport, Srila Prabhupada brings out the point that in Vedic sacrifices, when animals were sacrificed, that sacrifice was meant to do good both to the animal and to the beneficiary of the sacrifice. Beneficiary in the sense, the yagman, who is performing the sacrifice. Of course, the beneficiary is Krishna ultimately. But who is performing the sacrifice. So, whatever is there in the Vedic system was meant to do good. Whatever injunctions are there in the Shastra are meant exclusively to do good to all living entities. So here you see, the performer of the sacrifice, the animal which is being sacrificed, all of that was meant to do good to everybody involved. In contrast, Prabhupada brings out the point that in a medical laboratory, sometimes animals, there are experiments being done with animals. And we know that it needs no exaggeration, it needs no explanation that such experiments are demoniac. And it's not an exaggeration to say that such experiments are demoniac, because the whole purpose of the experiment is in the whole experiment, what happens to the animal is not at all considered. There's no question about considering what is happening to the animal, but rather the consideration is how I shall benefit at the cost of the animal which is being experimented with. In this regard, there is one nice story that Srila Prabhupada says. He gives the example of some boys, they were playing. Once there were some boys who were playing, and there were some frogs nearby. And Prabhupada actually is an expert storyteller. When he narrates stories, it's very, very humorous. So then these boys decided, oh, these frogs are nearby, so let's throw some stones at the dog. frogs. So then they began to pelt stones at the frogs. And the frogs began to protest. In fact, Prabhupada, the style in which he presents this protest is very interesting. The frogs tell the boys, "Sir," in fact the frogs refer to the boys as "Sir." "Sir, why are you throwing stones at us?" And the boys reply, "Oh, we're just playing." And then the frogs reply, "What is play for you is death for us." So, and then Prabhupada goes on to say that in the modern government imposes so many kinds of taxes, especially due to so-called scientific advancement, they need so much tax from the taxpayers. And then Prabhupada says, so what is play for the scientists is death for us. So here we see that what the scientists are playing with, they're experimenting. And the experiments have gone to really weird extents these days because they're trying to tamper with the genetic code of living entities. So we have a whole new dangerous field called genetic engineering. So they're actually trying to tamper with something very, very serious, and we'll see over a period in time how these experiments have extremely dangerous effects. So what's play for these scientists is actually death for us. But whereas in the Vedic culture, everything, every single activity would do only benefit. Whatever is prescribed in the Shastra would only benefit for everybody concerned. So then the question could be asked, okay, this sacrifice is being performed so that King Anga has a very nice child. But we'll see later that the son who was born to King Anga was Vena, and Vena created a lot of disturbance. So here we see that things are being done in the right manner. Sacrifice is being performed. Animals are being sacrificed in the right way. So all things are being done right. So then, but the result is King Vena. So how is that, is it apparently contradictory? Or is it perfectly fine? Actually, it's perfectly fine. Because Prabhupada goes on to explain that, especially in the next book, he begins to explain that the Lord gives the devotee the opportunity to make progress further and further, so that he may come back home, back to Godhead. Since the king was very liberal, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in order to increase his detachment from this material world, willed that a cruel son be born of the queen, so that the king would have to leave home. So here we see that ultimately, it is not something which was undesirable which happened. The birth of King Vena was by the will of the Supreme Lord, and it was to increase King Anga's detachment from this material world. So that's again something that we have to understand. When the Supreme Lord does something, he does something which is extremely beneficial. We may not see it as beneficial, but it is definitely beneficial. I was recently in Vrindavan on the 2nd of April. I was hearing a class on the radio. I still don't know who the speaker was, but it was a very, very good class, a very simple class, yet very profound. So at the end of the class, there was a question. The devotee who was asking the question wanted to know that sometimes Krishna reciprocates. Sometimes Krishna reciprocates very quickly. Sometimes he does not reciprocate at all. So how do we understand this phenomenon? That sometimes Krishna reciprocates, sometimes he reciprocates quickly, and sometimes he does not reciprocate at all. So then the speaker replied, he matter-of-factly said, "Prabhu, you are an illusion." So, Krishna reciprocates all the time. There is no time when Krishna does not reciprocate. Krishna reciprocates all the time with his devotees. This is a very essential aspect of our Krishna consciousness philosophy, that Krishna is actively involved in the life of a devotee. Prabhupada writes that when we take to the process of devotional service, Krishna actually directly takes charge. Of course, directly takes charge could mean through the internal potency, not through the external potency. So Krishna is actively involved in the life of a devotee, and there is no such incident in the life of a devotee which happens by chance, but rather it is by the will of Krishna. And we have to understand that whatever happens, there is a plan of the Lord to increase our devotional service. In fact, one of the very last words which Srila Prabhupada spoke while he was on this planet, you can see that video where he is lying on his bed in Vrindavan and he speaks very faintly. His consciousness is very crisp, very clear. And he says, everything, every moment in this world is moving and acting by the supreme desire of Krishna. This consciousness is called Krishna consciousness. So this is Krishna consciousness, where a devotee sees everything as the will of the Lord. And this is one of the last instructions that Prabhupada gave us, to see everything as the supreme desire of Krishna. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami in the Chaitanya Charitamrita says that this good and bad, they're all illusions. There's no such thing as good and bad. So whatever we consider in our conception as good may not be actually good. It may be an illusion. And whatever we may consider bad from our estimation may actually be good. So this good and bad from our estimation are simply illusions. But rather, whatever Krishna does, that is really good. So that is our standard of goodness. That whatever Krishna does, we accept that as goodness. In fact, Mother Urmila in her Bhagavatam class during the Gaur Purnima festival brought out this point very, very clearly, that there's no such thing as good. What we think is good is not actually good. She brought out this point that we may think, okay, there are people in this material world. I don't remember the exact. I don't remember the exact thing that she said, but I remember the essence of what she said. She said that we may think, okay, there are people in this material world. After all, they're not all that bad. They're good. And then she went on to explain how actually this is an illusion, because when someone is not a devotee of Krishna, he or she is driven by fear. And what does fear do? Fear makes you compromise. So if one is fearful of losing one's position, when one is fearful of losing one's wealth, or when one is fearful of losing anything for that matter, then one compromises. So unless one becomes a devotee of Krishna, there's no question of being fearless. And unless one is fearless, one is bound to compromise. Therefore, there is no such thing as good independent of Krishna consciousness. Rather, when one is in Krishna consciousness, then whatever happens by the will of Krishna is actually good. And because when one is in Krishna consciousness, one becomes fearless, so irrespective of what happens, one accepts it as the mercy of the Lord. One is fearless. So if we are still driven by fear, it is a symptom that we have still not surrendered to Krishna properly. So if we are afraid, oh, what if Krishna puts me in a situation which is very difficult? What if Krishna does this to me? That means we have not advanced sufficiently enough in Krishna consciousness, and we have a lot of work to do. So we have to understand this basic point, that devotee by his nature is fearless. So as we progress in Krishna consciousness, we develop this quality of fearlessness, and we begin to accept anything that happens to our life, in our life, is by the mercy of the Supreme Lord. In fact, in Prabhupada's own life, you see, throughout his life, right in the early stages of his life, we see how Prabhupada was married to a woman whom he did not like very much. So Prabhupada came up with this idea that he wanted to accept an additional wife. But his father, Gaur Mohan De, persuaded him that no, it is good that this wife of yours is not to your liking, because eventually this will help you. And later on, Prabhupada went on to say that actually my father was right. Because my wife is not very much to my liking, I could easily take sannyas. So Prabhupada saw everything as the mercy of the Supreme Lord right from the beginning stages of his life. And if we read the poem that he wrote when he was in Vrindavan before coming to the West, he writes that all these people who gave me so much affection, my father, my mother, and all these people, so all of them who gave me so much affection, where are they all now? You know? And then he says, this is the play of Maya. I don't remember the exact words, but the he says, this is the play of Maya. And then he says, it gives me a laugh. Now, that's interesting because usually this is a condition when people are depressed, that everybody has abandoned me, there is nobody wants me, and people who really loved me are no more with me. So this is a situation where people feel very, very depressed. But Prabhupada says, it gives me a laugh. So this is the consciousness of a great devotee, that a devotee sees everything as the mercy of the Lord. And later on, Prabhupada would go on to say, when he established the Krishna consciousness movement in the West, he said that in India I had a few children. Krishna took away those children. But now in the West, I have so many sons and daughters. And Prabhupada said, in fact, he would affectionately refer to his grihastha disciples as his parents. So he would say, I had a very affectionate father and mother. Now I have so many fathers and mothers. Because they took very nice care of Prabhupada. So we see that a pure devotee takes everything as the mercy of the Lord. So that's precisely the point that Prabhupada is trying to bring out in this pastime of Vena being born to King Anga, that it was simply meant to increase his detachment from this material world. So that is the nature of Krishna's activity, that he creates situations where we become detached from material activity. And this is one of the essential aspects of our Krishna consciousness movement, that we can test our advancement in Krishna consciousness by seeing how much we are being detached from matter. So unless we see that, there is something wrong. Prabhupada very clearly mentions that the test of one's advancement in Krishna consciousness can be seen by how much one becomes detached from sex desire. And in fact, this is the reason which attracted me to Krishna consciousness while I was in high school. I was in a boys' school, so you can imagine what a boys' school is like. So when I read Prabhupada's book, he said that when one takes to the process of Krishna consciousness, this one's sex desire becomes diminished. And then when I took to Krishna consciousness, I noticed, the sex desire is almost vanishing. In fact, at one point I thought, it's vanished fully. But later, I realized that it's important that one sticks to the process of Krishna consciousness properly. Because at a point in time in my life, I realized that when I started committing offenses, then the sex desire began to come back. And then things began to go haywire. But fortunately, by the mercy of some great souls, I was rescued. And once again, when I began to practice Krishna consciousness properly, I noticed once again that the sex desire was diminishing. So, this is the effect of when we practice Krishna consciousness, we can test it by ourselves, that material desires diminish. So, and we cannot, if we are practicing Krishna consciousness and also our material desires are increasing, and we are practicing Krishna consciousness anyway, then we should actually be alarmed that something is going wrong with our lives. We are actually supposed to tangibly see that our material desires are decreasing. And so not only material desires are increasing, our taste for Krishna consciousness is simultaneously increasing. So, we see that there are many examples in the Bhagavatam where we see the example of Kardama Muni, that in his particular example, we see that he had a material desire and he prayed to the Supreme Lord. He did not try to fulfill that material desire independently, neither by his own will. We see in Kardama Muni's pastime that he created so many beautiful ladies after he was married. So it is very possible that he could have actually created a very beautiful lady and he could have got married to her, but he doesn't do that. He actually depends fully on the Supreme Lord. And Prabhupada writes in that chapter that he could have actually prayed to Lord Shiva's wife, because if one wants a very nice wife, One can pray to Lord Shiva's wife, Uma. But Kardamuni doesn't do that. But rather, he teaches the standard of proper devotional service, where even if he has a material desire, he actually depends on the Supreme Lord. So, we see that neither he creates a very beautiful wife out of his own ability, neither does he, depend on Uma, but rather he approaches the Supreme Lord. And in fact, he was even aware that Devahuti was there on the planet, because you had that Gandharva who fell off his airplane seeing the beauty of Devahuti. So Kardamuni was aware of that such a lady existed. He didn't even pray to the Supreme Lord, "Oh, she looks very appropriate. Maybe I can get married to her." But rather, he simply prays to the Supreme Lord. He in fact says, "I'm so shameless." When the Supreme Lord appears, he says, "I'm so shameless that I'm practicing devotional service and I should be thinking of something higher. But yet, I'm not able to overcome this desire. So kindly grant me a suitable wife." We see that Krishna, he granted a very, very appropriate wife for the Kardama Muni. So much so that he himself he appears through the womb of Devahuti. Nevertheless, we see that Kardama Muni, he sticks to the point. He tells Devahuti that I have this material desire. I mean, he had this material desire, so he gets married to Devahuti. And he says, "The moment I give you a son, I will leave home." So we see here that the Supreme Lord is himself appearing as the son of Kardama Muni, but yet he thinks it is important to be detached from matter, detached from material life, and he gives up family life. And similarly, we see in the example of Kunti. So one can ask, okay, the Supreme Lord is there, so what is the need for Kardama Muni to give up family life? So we see in the example of Kunti that Kunti, she prays that, please remove my attachment please remove my attachment to my family members. And there, Prabhupada writes in the purport that one can ask this question, that Kunti, all her children were pure devotees. So then, what is she actually trying to pray? She's trying to say that, Prabhupada explains that although her children were pure devotees, and although she herself was a very exalted devotee, nevertheless, there was some consideration of, she preferred her children over the Yadus. She wanted Krishna to be with her children. So there Prabhupada explained, so that is a material consideration, although the children were pure devotees. So we see that the great devotees in general, they have set the example that one should eventually give up material life and material conceptions fully, and fully dedicate himself to the process of Krishna consciousness and fully spread the Krishna consciousness movement. Of course, we also see that Prabhupada did say that if one is Krishna conscious, fully Krishna conscious, one need not give up family life. So Prabhupada did say both things, but however, overwhelmingly he said that one should eventually give up family life and take to full Krishna consciousness. So then one can be asked, what determines whether one can be in family life or one cannot be in family life? So the example can be given of the Pandavas. You can see, the Pandavas actually wanted to give up their kingdom immediately. But Narada Muni instructs them, no, you cannot do that now. So Pandavas were actually in that stage that although they were, they were kings, they had so much material opulence, so they were not attached to that material opulence, they wanted to give it up. But then Narada Muni, their spiritual master, instructs them, no, don't do it now. When Krishna leaves the planet, then you can do it. So we can see that example where, that's the standard of pure devotional service, where they're, although they may be in that situation of material opulence, they're not attached to that. In a moment, they can give up that opulence. So that is the state to which we have to come first. Then we can think, then depending on the instruction of our superiors, then we can decide whether to remain or not remain. But first of all, we have to come to that platform where that we have to be completely detached from matter. Even though we may have so many material opulences, one should reach that stage where although one is surrounded by material opulence, one is still not attached to that, just like the Pandavas. So at the drop, at the moment Krishna left the planet, immediately they left. But before that also they were detached, but by the instruction of superiors, they still remained as kings and they performed all their duties as kings. So this is the point that we have to understand in this pastime of King Anga and King Vena, that ultimately we have to reach a stage where one is exclusively dependent on the Supreme Lord and not dependent on or not dependent for other things, for security or due to attachment or due to whatever. One comes to the stage where one is fully dependent on the mercy of the Supreme Lord. And to come to that stage, Krishna may do various things. Krishna may do various things. Of course, he does things according to, Krishna is not a sadistic God who tries to give you something which you cannot handle and then he laughs at you. No, he doesn't do that. He is very well aware of what you are and he personally handles your situation. And everything that he creates in your life is meant for you to advance in your Krishna consciousness. And I'm sure that many of you would know from your own lives and from the lives of others that there are many such situations where one can come in touch or when one can advance in Krishna consciousness by the mercy of the Supreme Lord. And I have one interesting story to tell you. Last year during Gaur Purnima, there was one proper disciple who came to change a traveler's check in my office. And he said, I'm very fond of traveler's check. And then he went on to tell a story. He said that when he was in Delhi, during those days, when Prabhupada was around in India, but he was not a devotee, and he had come to Delhi. So in the Delhi railway station, he had a traveler's check and he wanted to encash that traveler's check. So he was asking people around where to encash this traveler's check. There was some boy there and he said, okay, can I have a look at it? And he saw the check. The moment this Prabhu had the check, he took the check and ran away. And he said, this was the only thing that I had with me. I had no money. And so he said, the next few days I had to spend at the railway station. I didn't know what to do because I had no money. So he was still sleeping in the railway station. And lo and behold, Prabhupada's disciples came there to distribute Bhakti Garden. And so he took a Bhakti Garden and he said, began to read the Bhakti Garden and then he joined the devotees and he eventually became a devotee. And he said, so I'm very fond of these traveler's checks because it is because of this that I became a devotee. So we see that what is apparently a very unfortunate situation can actually be a design of the Lord for us to advance in our Krishna consciousness. And we see that this is the nature of a devotee who always depends on the Supreme Lord. And it is not that Krishna is a faraway reality, but rather the most beautiful aspect of Krishna consciousness is that Prabhupada has made Krishna a very, very tangible reality. And I remember in one Vyasa Puja offering, Pankajangri Prabhu made this point that for several years, for several centuries probably, we've had storybooks about Krishna, we've had so many different books about Krishna. But Krishna was not a tangible reality. But when you read Prabhupada's books, in fact, this is my own experience, when I read this Krishna book which made me take to Krishna consciousness, Krishna was a tangible reality. And Krishna, the experience of Vrindavan, when you read Krishna book, the experience of Vrindavan comes alive. And it's not an experience which fades away. Even to this day, that experience of Vrindavan highly lingers in my mind. That experience when I read the Krishna book. So Krishna, Prabhupada made Krishna a tangible reality. And he has given us the deities of the Lord. So every day we go in front of the deities. Just now we finished the Darshanarthi. We go in front of the deities. They're beautifully dressed. Govinda Madhipurusham, just out of this world. So we see the tangible connection with Krishna. And in fact, Prabhupada taught us that in our Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, the deities are non-different from Krishna. And in fact, as far as I remember, the Ramanuja philosophy is slightly different. They say the deity is matter which is spiritualized. I'm not sure if it's right, but I'll clarify that. But as far as I know, that's what it is. But in our philosophy, the deity is non-different from the Supreme Lord. And once again, when Prabhupada mentions the story of Sakshi Gopal, he narrates it in a very, very interesting manner. He says how this old Brahmana went along with his assistant boy And when he met, when they went to the temple of Sakshi, I mean, went to the, initially it was Gopal in Vrindavan. So there, he's so pleased because during those days to travel to Vrindavan was very difficult. So they traveled all the way to Vrindavan, and this young boy was there to assist this old man to travel. And this old man was a Brahmana, whereas this boy from a lower caste was an assistant. So, but this man was so happy that this boy rendered such wonderful service to him. So when he reached the temple of, when he reached the temple of Gopal, so he wanted to promise this boy that, okay, once you go back, once we go back to our village, I'll marry you to my daughter. I'll get you married to my daughter. But this boy was also a great devotee. So he told this old man, oh no, you're talking in front of the deities. So whatever you talk in front of the deities, you'd be obliged to follow. Don't do this. Don't promise. I'm not qualified. When you go back to your village, there'll be a lot of objections. So please don't do this. So he pleaded with the old man. But the old man was still insistent. No, no, you're a very good boy. You've done so much work to me. I will manage all my sons who may object. So, but then he said, look, you don't have to do this in front of the deities. Once you promise in front of the deities, they are real persons. You're obliged to carry out whatever you promised to them. But nevertheless, the old man went ahead and promised. And Prabhupada goes on to say, so once they reach the village, so as expected, there is objection. And the old man's sons began to object. Oh, and Prabhupada says, oh, you took my father to Vrindavan and you gave him some LSD. You gave some LSD. And then you convinced him that you'll marry my sister. And so like this, there is objection. And so then there is a big commotion. And then the panchayat, village panchayat, they were brought into the picture. And this boy said that for my sake, I don't mind if I don't marry this girl. But this gentleman, he has promised in front of the deities. And when one promises in front of the deities, one is obliged to fulfill that promise. So then the panchayat, the members, they decided, okay, let your deity come as witness. So then this boy, he goes to Vrindavan and he tells the deities, see, we came here, you know, we came here, and this old gentleman, he promised that he'll marry his daughter to me. So now there is this whole commotion. He explained the whole thing to the Lord, just like you would explain to any person. And he said, so now you please come with me as witness. So the deity replied, I am a deity, I cannot walk. Then Prabhupada says, the boy replies to the deity, if you can talk, you can also walk. So then the deity accepts that and begins to walk. So we know that story, how finally the deity gives witness. So here we see that the deities are not just some, as Prabhupada would often explain to us, not just made of some matter, but rather they're actually very, very, they're actually interactive personalities. And in fact, recently when I was in Vrindavan, I heard Japadak Maharaj tell this pastime, a fairly recent pastime in Jagannath Mandir, when they brought Giriraj to Jagannath Mandir. Then Jagannath appeared in a dream to the pujari and started complaining, ever since you brought Giriraj, he's eating all my food, I'm not getting any food. So then they started feeding Giriraj separately. So this is the nature of the deities. They like to interact with their devotees. So if we approach the deities with that mood, okay, these are actually people, you know. So then they interact. They are also very fond of interacting with their devotees. And they interact. They may not interact to us in their, we may not perceive their Sachidananda form, but nevertheless, they do interact. And I remember that in the early days of Krishna consciousness, when I took to Krishna consciousness, there was one boy who had a lot of problem with his parents. So because, you know, in India, when people take to Krishna consciousness, the parents usually object a lot. And there are various forms of that objection. So then, not everybody finds it easy to overcome that obstacle. So I remember the temple president saying strongly to this boy, he said, look, if your parents are a reality, Krishna is also a reality. You understand? So then, eventually, he got it. But so the point is that Krishna is not some obscure deity living so many millions of miles away, but rather Krishna is situated right close to us in our hearts, and he's present as a deity, and he's always willing to always offer us assistance for us to advance in our Krishna consciousness. So if we begin to see everything that happens in our life as the mercy of the Supreme Lord, then there is only excitement in Krishna consciousness. There is no scope for depression, there's no scope for anything else. Of course, I may say these things, but when it actually happens either to me or to some others in this room, but it may be difficult, but as long as we depend on the mercy of the Supreme Lord, it's possible. And I can tell you one thing from my own personal experience. Once, somewhere in the mid-90s, I had a severe form of malaria. And I was very sick, almost delirious. We just couldn't, even though the doctors gave me treatment, I was completely delirious. Couldn't move, which is completely helpless. But then I realized, look, this is a situation where nobody can do anything, including the best doctors. So I said, okay, let me surrender to the Lord. And I began to think, this is the mercy of the Supreme Lord. You know, and the moment I began to think, this is the mercy of the Supreme Lord, I began to feel as if the Lord is simply smiling. You know? Of course, I can't say that I actually saw the lips of the Lord, but that impression, I mean, lingers in my mind even to this day, that I began to feel, okay, the Lord is actually smiling at me. This is the mercy of the Supreme Lord. And surely enough, from that point on, I no longer felt miserable, although I was running very high temperatures, 103 degrees or something. And then, I was just lying down. And it was just that the fact that the Lord was smiling at my condition was something which really stuck in my mind. And it sticks to my mind even to this day. And something more interesting happened after this. So after about a couple of hours of lying down like this, there was one devotee who came to my house, one of my friends. And he had some difficulties with his Krishna consciousness. And so he began to ask questions. And I was in a condition barely able to speak. But nevertheless, I was a little bit blissful because of the fact that I was thinking the Lord is smiling upon me. And then, I began to think, okay, although I can barely speak, nevertheless, this devotee has approached me to help him in his Krishna consciousness. So I should try to help. So I began to slowly speak. Gradually, after about half an hour, you won't believe this, but this is a fact, I began to sit up in bed. And then I thought, everything had just vanished. And I looked as though everything was normal. So then I thought, okay, first of all, we have to depend on the Supreme Lord. Then we have to preach. Then everything in our life would go right. So the next day, I had to go to the doctor. And he knew that this is a very severe form of malaria. So we were even wondering whether, because when I called up in that delirious condition, my parents called up, he said, maybe you'd admit him to the hospital. So he said, in any case, if it decreases, then you can keep him at home. But otherwise, you have to bring him to the hospital in the next couple of hours. But as I explained, these things happened, I didn't have to go to the hospital. So then the next day, I had to go for a routine check, because the doctor wanted to ensure that everything is in order with me. Because this is a form of malaria which affects my brain, and I was already delirious. So he was worried whether anything had gone wrong, anything would go wrong with me. So the next day when I went to the doctor, I was sitting up in bed and I was chatting with him, I was trying to talk to him about Krishna consciousness, joking, laughing. So he told the nurse, please check his temperature. And then the nurse checked and it was 103.5 degrees. And he was shocked. He said, 103? He said, maybe you checked it wrong. Then he called another nurse and he said, use another device, check his temperature again. And then she also checked my temperature, and it was 103.5. And here I was, completely oblivious to that fact that I was running such a high temperature. I didn't even feel it. I was sitting to the doctor and talking to him about Krishna consciousness. And then, at this point, I was curious, because then I asked the doctor. I was actually trying to understand this analytically. How is this possible? So then I asked him, why do you think, although I'm running such high temperature, is it possible that sometimes due to malaria you don't feel this temperature? And then he said only one thing. He said, it is Krishna's mercy. Then I said, yes, this is Krishna's mercy. So this is something which I experienced in my own life when I just let go, when I was really suffering and I just let go. Then immediately I felt relieved. Not only relief, the second stage was when I started actually preaching about Krishna consciousness, I became fully, perfectly alright. And although my body was in a diseased condition, I was oblivious to it. So, from that I began to understand that no matter what happens in my life, I simply surrender then Krishna takes charge. It's not that everything that happened in my life after that I was fully surrendered, no. But as I was surrendering, I could realize the mercy of the Supreme. As much as I surrendered, to that much extent I could see the mercy of the Supreme Lord. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur writes that we are drawn to the attractions and repulsions of this world. We are drawn to the attractions and repulsions of this world to the amount of intervening distance there is between Krishna's lotus feet and us. To the amount of intervening distance there is between the lotus feet of Krishna and us, to that extent we are attracted to the attractions and repulsions of this world. So as we try to close that gap, then we become above the attractions and repulsions of this material world. So I think I'll stop there. I'm sorry if I spoke fast, because as I mentioned earlier, this is a total mistake. I was not supposed to speak on this verse, I was supposed to speak tomorrow. So this is an extempore class, so I'm sorry if it was discontinuous or if I spoke very fast. So if there are any comments or questions? Yes. Compromise could be of various forms. The gross forms of compromise are, of course, breaking the regulative principles. The subtle forms of compromise, which we know by ourselves, which only we know. What are the thoughts in our mind? What are our aspirations? What are our desires? Are they in line with for us to become more advanced in Krishna consciousness? Or are they more just like, okay, if I, as I keep increasing my money, my life will get better? And that's definitely not something which Prabhupada taught us. He said, earn enough so that you maintain yourself, but try to dedicate your life for Krishna consciousness. That's one. There are various forms of it. Like, it is not that, because we have the philosophy of Yukta Vairagya, therefore we keep accumulating and hoarding things or trying to do. I mean, it's not that we have to get involved in a material activity and dovetail it in the service of the Lord. But rather, the philosophy of Krishna consciousness is, if you are in a situation, try to dovetail that situation in the service of the Lord. Not that we have to create situations and then dovetail it. So that's one obvious example where we're going wrong. Like we have to think of how we have to improve our Krishna consciousness. Not that we are trying to create more and more material situations and then try to dovetail those situations in the service of the Lord. Rather, we are trying to decrease those material situations and trying to increase our Krishna consciousness. Now the question could be asked, what is necessary, what is not necessary? That is an individual thing. Like what is one person's comfort level may be different from another person's comfort level. In fact, they did a study in America where they found out that once people had everything to live comfortably, then the more money they got, they only got frustrated. And what is individual level of comfort is different for different people. So it is ultimately an individual question, but one would personally know what, okay, this much is enough for me. One knows it, everybody knows it. As long as we are sincere, we know it. Okay, this much is enough for me. Okay, so then we try to spend more time in Krishna consciousness, not to try to increase our material necessities and material arrangements, but rather, okay, everybody has different comfort levels, okay, and according to one's comfort level, once one reaches that stage, then no more. Because sometimes what happens is that devotees, when they practice artificial austerity, they're thinking of all the time, I'm suffering, instead of thinking about, okay, I'm supposed to increase my rounds, I'm supposed to be more Krishna conscious. They're only thinking, oh, I don't have money. So the point is, that's why Prabhupada said, for the grihastha, as he said, that I'm no longer taking responsibility for marriages in this world. If you're getting married, you please take responsibility to provide for your family. So he gave that responsibility to individual devotees. The individual devotees can decide, okay, what is their comfort level? But the point, okay, this is about grihasthas. But whereas for the other orders of life, they have to, it's a more question of internally, what are your desires? And whether you're trying to fulfill that desire in some form or the other. And ideally, you should not be doing it. But if you're trying to do it, at least it has to be done in a proper, legitimate way. And eventually one has to come to that stage, okay, by practice of Krishna consciousness, these unwanted material desires should go away. So, these are some of the things that I could just think of.
Hare Krishna. I was scheduled to give the class today. I got the little ticket, you know. And this morning I came, and usually I leave before the announcements are made, but they mentioned your name. So I consulted with the devotees that make the arrangements. I said, what's going on? And they said, well, let me check. And they checked. And then they came back and they said, well, you're giving the class. So I had studied for 3 days to give this class.
You just told me.
So it's like a funny thing happened to me on the way to the class or something. But anyway, so I went home, and after hearing that I was going to give the class, I went home and I studied more. You know, instead of chanting, I did more studying. So I had a lot of things to say about Ramanujacharya and his very saintly association and his appreciation and all of his different activities. But your class is actually very edifying for me. It's Krishna's arrangement. I can understand that I'm becoming a little distant from the actual process of surrender, and so I much appreciate your class. Anyway, there was a lot of very wonderful things in Yamunacharya's life, and we have a little more time, so maybe I could just speak a few of those things.
Sure.
He basically was the person who revitalized Vaishnavism. He was a Sri Vaishnava, and he presented the many facts of, or disputed many of the so-called facts that, Sankaracharya had established. We know that Buddha appeared, and then he was a great reformer, but he rejected the Vedas, and he substituted these atheistic views, and then Buddha advanced the path of Ahimsa. Then Sankaracharya came and he overpowered Buddhism, and he basically restored the Vedas as the predominant literatures. But he preached a monism that was very much appreciated and accepted. It's interesting how these things come in different stages, how the different the different levels of our God consciousness have developed over the last 2,000 years. And so Sankaracharya was defeated by Ramanuja. Well, he was actually the established teacher, and then Ramanujacharya came, and he began to defeat the different positions of Sankaracharya. He made many of the arguments that we use in our philosophy, in our presentation of Krishna consciousness. He made many of those arguments, and they are to this day very useful for us in presenting Krishna consciousness. I have a list of some of those arguments that I found very fascinating. Actually, Ramanujacharya has a very fascinating life. He was attacked by his guru and given so many difficulties by his guru's disciples. They plotted to kill him. There's a very wonderful story about that, how he was tipped off by his cousin, Govinda Bhatta, and they went off and they hid, and Govinda Bhatta came back and told the followers of Yadava Prakash that he was eaten by a tiger. And so, actually, just before that, Ramanuja had left Yadava Prakash's ashram, his teaching, and established his own school. Yadava Prakash became very anxious about this and wanted to defeat him or actually kill him. So, at any rate, Govinda Bhatta came back and told them that he'd been eaten by a tiger and that he was dead. So they pretended to be very upset, but they were actually very happy. So they went on with their pilgrimage, but Ramanujacharya was left basically just in the forest, lost, didn't know where to go. And then he walked for a ways, and then he got a drink from two people, to a man and a woman at a well. So he took the drink, and then he went to sleep. And then he had a dream that Ramachandra and Sita came to him and they walked him all the way back to his village. So he was amused by the dream. When he woke up, though, he realized he was just on the outskirts of his village, and that this had actually been an intervention of the Lord. So he was very impressed. And he didn't say anything about the attack that he'd had or the plot that had been hatched, and he just basically began to teach again. And so when Yadava Prakash and his disciples returned to the village, they were astounded. They were just like really shocked. How is this possible? At any rate, there's his doctrines. He basically reestablished the bhakti cult. He really revised the bhakti cult, and he appreciated the presence of Krishna and the deity and so forth. He had one teacher, Yamunacharya, and Yamunacharya had died previous to his arrival at his place. Yamunacharya was very much impressed. He came to Ramanujacharya one day. Ramanujacharya was a householder and was in his house. And he came and he was in the form of a mendicant. He was just passing by. So Ramanujacharya treated him very nicely and brought him into the house, and they began to converse. And Ramanuja appreciated that this is actually a very saintly person. He fell on the floor and asked him to become his guru. So Yamunacharya did this, and then he went on back to Sri Rangam. Later, Ramanujacharya heard that he was ill, that Yamunacharya was ill, and so he went to see him. And when he got there, he had his hands. One hand was in this position like this, at peace, and the other hand was clenched like this, in a fist. So Ramanuja appeared. He went into the room, and he realized that this was a message. And so he began to interpret the message for all those persons who were there. And basically, the three things that he presented to the population to the world were the things that unfolded the fingers on Yamunacharya's hand. One of those things was, let's see if I can find that. I'll just read this. Actually, it's a little easier on you. The left hand of Yamunacharya was posed in a yoga posture for peace, and the three fingers extended, and the thumb and forefinger joined together at the tips. His right hand, however, was at his side, but clenched into a fist. All the disciples were struck with wonder about the position of their guru's right hand, and none of them could understand the meaning. As everyone looked on in wonder, Ramanuja broke the silence by declaring, "Our guru, the revered Yamunacharya, has three desires that he wishes to be fulfilled. To protect the people in general who are deluded." Hold on. Oh, jeez. Excuse me. All right. I will protect the people in general who are deluded by impersonalism by bestowing upon them the nectar of surrender at the lotus feet of Narayan. As Ramanuja spoke, one of the fingers of Yamunacharya's right hand extended downward. Then Ramanuja said, "For the well-being of the people of the world, I will prepare a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra that will reestablish the Supreme Person as the supreme ultimate reality." At this, the second finger extended. And Ramanuja continued speaking, "And in order to honor Parasara Muni, who in ancient times established the relation between the jivas, the living entities, and the Ishwara, the Supreme Person, I shall name one of my disciples who is greatly learned and devoted after him." So Ramanuja then became silent, and the third finger of the right hand of Yamunacharya extended, and everyone present was amazed to see this miracle. From that day on, they all accepted Ramanuja as their leader and guide. So Ramanuja continued to live at Sri Rangam for the remainder of his life. In due course, all three vows were fulfilled by him. He lived for many years, and he actually lived to be about 120 years old. And there was a very nice section here about his passing. And of course, there was a very famous incident with his disciple Koresh. There was a king who was very much against the Vaishnavas and had been encouraged by impersonalists to attack Ramanujacharya. So Ramanuja had a disciple who was very devoted to him in Koresh, and Koresh went to in his place to this king. And so he was tortured. He was blinded, actually. He refused to submit to the king's presentation. And he was a Shaivite, yeah. And so he refused to submit and basically was blinded, and then he made his way back to Ramanujacharya. So Ramanujacharya performed a miracle. He was so impressed. Actually, Koresh was thinking that because I'm saving my guru from this difficulty, I'm actually not disturbed by it. He was, even though it was a horrific experience, he wasn't disturbed. So Ramanuja took Koresh before the deity of Narayan and with fervent prayers asked the deity to restore his sight. The master of the universe, you are the protector and well-wisher of your devotees. Kindly be merciful and renew the eyes of Koresh, who, without protest, made the supreme sacrifice. At that very moment, Koresh felt a gentle breeze blow across his brow, and he immediately regained his sight. This is a really amazing miracle, you know, because of course they burned his eyes out with iron rods, which pretty much defeats your sight forever. So Ramanuja's last wishes, I'll read those, because they're very, very, very sweet. So if, when he was passing away, he was about ready to die and leave his body, he prayed to the Lord that he had done as much service as he could possibly do in this body. And his disciples, though, begged him to stay for three more days. So he spoke his last instructions to those who were very near and dear to him. Always remain in the service and or in the company of and serve those souls devoted to Godhead, just as you would serve your own spiritual preceptor. But putting the devotees on the position as important as serving to the guru, as service to the devotees is as important as service to the guru. Have faith in the teachings of the Vedas and in the words of the great saints. Never become a slave of your senses. Always strive to conquer the three great enemies of self-realization, lust, anger, and greed. Worship Narayan and take pleasure in the uttering of the holy names of God as your only refuge. Sincerely serve the devotees of Godhead by service to great devotees. The highest service is done, and one quickly gains the supreme mercy. So, remembering these things, you should live happily in this world for the attainment of the next. So with these departing words, Ramanuja, keeping his head on the lap of Govinda and his mind fixed in spiritual trance, he relinquished his mortal body and entered the realm of Vaikuntha. So Ramanuja is indeed a great theologian whose life and teachings have a lasting influence on the development of theistic thought in India. Ramanuja's introduction of the Godhead as the absolute entity with super subjective characteristics and his having pioneered the dawning of devotion to Godhead opened the doors for future theistic reformers who would in due course fully reveal the highest potential of the soul in the loving relationship with God and his eternal servants. And as a prayer, I take refuge at the feet of Sri Ramanuja, our venerable master, who during the dark night of impersonal conception of divinity carried the torch lit of knowledge and thus illuminated the path of devotion to the personality of Godhead. So this reminds me of the prayers Namaste Narasimha, I mean rather our pranams to Srila Prabhupada. that he delivered us from impersonalism and voidism, and so we can understand this carrying is going on throughout the line of the different Vaishnavacharyas. Thank you very much.
Bhagavatam ki, Ramanujacharya ki. Yeah.